Good morning, everybody. My name is Peter Sumlehack, and I'm going to do the old Jackson 5 routine up here, which is hold the microphone. Can I get a little more gain there? And can everybody hear me okay back there? So I have an hour. I've been told multiple times by my people that I need to be lively. So I may end up doing a little dance. Who knows what's going to happen? It's always a surprise. But I'm here to talk about hardware mashups and something we call the long tail of gadgets. But what I'd like to do first is take a poll here, because sometimes I feel really old at these events. But there are a couple, I think, things that have happened over the past 20, 30 years that help inform where this is now and where it's going. So just quickly, how many people here were alive when ATMs first came out? Oh, good. I don't know, 1943 or something? I don't know. It was a while ago. Okay, so my father, it's kind of a funny story. My father still refuses to use ATMs. He'll take a check, he'll go to a teller, and he'll get the cash. And I'm like, why on earth would you do that? Because he really wants the human touch, whatever that means. It's probably a woman there. But anyway, the point is that what ATMs did for me when I first saw them come out is that for me it was like, holy smokes, I now have the ability to get money anytime I want. Now that sounds like big deal. But back then, it was really kind of a radical notion. Like 3 a.m, I can go and I can get, you know, 10 bucks and go to 7-Eleven and buy a Slurpee or whatever, how old I was, I don't remember. But for me, that was like the opening point of what started to become a sequence of events that I think we've all come to recognize. Like, so now when we go to the airport, how many people actually stand in line anymore to get a ticket, right? Very few people. In fact, you can check in online, right? Amazon came out and basically spoiled everybody and said, hey, you know, if you want to buy a book from your cell phone at midnight from Belgium, hey, go right ahead, you know? And the point I'm trying to make is that over time, technology has been progressing in such a way that it's been giving the consumer or us, the end users, more and more power, more and more control over the things that are important to us in our life. One of my favorite examples, and one that plays nicely in this space, because it's a physical example, is Home Depot, right? How many people know the Home Depot's tagline? You can do it, we can help. And what's amazing about that tagline, keep that tagline in mind as we go through this, because Home Depot in many ways is a platform. And it's a great store, but before Home Depot you had hardware stores and you had other kinds of specialties, so lumber yards and so on. Home Depot was the first place to put all these different pieces and parts in one place. And what was nice about Home Depot, I like to work with wood. And because of that, I can go in and I can look at the lumber yard and I can say, you know, 2x4s, 4x4s, and so on. I can sort of envision what I would like to build with those things. Maybe I want to build a doghouse, or I want to build an extension to my kitchen. But I have this skill set where I can go and get the pieces and parts that I want from Home Depot. But if I'm not a woodworker, I still want a doghouse. Well, I can go a couple of aisles over and I can buy the hardware kit, right? Everything's cut, I can still build it, have fun. If I don't want to do that, I can go a couple aisles over and actually buy the doghouse already made. And then a couple aisles over, I can hire somebody to do it for me, right? So Home Depot provided the first sort of platform for what now is loosely called home improvement, but really it's a do-it-yourself thing. Now Home Depot is like a $122 billion retailer. It's like the second largest retailer in the world, all by releasing this native sort of, I think, feeling that everybody has, which people like to do things on their own. They like to have control. They like to build things. They like to exercise their own creativity. So what I'm here to talk about today is how this trend, which has been, you know, percolating for a while, mostly in the digital space, is now starting to move with a little more steam into the physical space. For example, how many people here have design their own Nike sneakers or their own Timbuktu bag or bought everything off of Zazzle or Threadless, right? I'd say half the room. And that's an interesting trend, because now what organizations are beginning to realize is that by shifting some of the innovative potential away from the center facility into the hands of users, that's a good thing. It's a competitive advantage. One of the things that we call the long tail of gadgets, Chris Anderson has given us a huge benefit by giving us a little tagline, which now makes great sense of something which before is fairly complicated to understand, but now it's, I think, a lot easier. And, you know, long tail economics basically says that in most sort of the markets, you have this idea that there's something called the short head, which is the left-hand side of there, which are all the hits, all the things that sell a lot, right? And then down here, you have the niche, which is a long tail, which is things, it could be digital or otherwise, that don't sell as many copies because the audiences aren't as big. But I'm from New York, and it's important for me to represent. We don't call it the long tail. We call it the pizza tail. And I bring it up because it's an interesting visualization, I think, that makes a little more sense what I want to talk about, is that I'm talking about electronics today. And electronics, you have, you know, basically, if you have anyone who have been to CES, you have, I think, 7 or 8 distinct categories of device, right? You can name them on 2 hands. You got cell phones, MP3 players, DVDs, LCD televisions, and so on. It's been that way for a long time. Those are the pepperonis on this picture. And in pepperoni land, it's the business is hard because, and I'll talk about this in my next slide, there are lots and lots of things moving against you in this part, in this world, because if you look at how you need to invest, you have to now invest, you know, millions of dollars in something which you hope is going to sell millions of units. So becoming a pepperoni is hard, and then once you get there, it's actually pretty hard to stay there. But the long tail in this picture is the cheese, right? It's all the area between the pepperonis, right? And the way I like to actually describe the cheese is every device you've ever wanted but couldn't find any place, right? We all have one of those, I'm sure, and I'm sure it's all different. Let me give you some examples for me. When I started the company Bug Labs, it was really because I really wanted the product that we're making. And the product we're making is a completely modular hardware device that allows you to build devices like Legos, just snap things together. And the inspiration was, in fact, Legos. In 2001, I live in Manhattan, and it was in October, my son was born. And at that time, everybody was worried about a second attack. Anybody who lives in Manhattan knows that everyone was just freaking out. I think it was the same thing too in DC. And for the most part, we spent a lot of time on the cell phones talking to people saying, hey, you know, where are you going? How long are you going to be there? If something happens, how do I find you? It became very tedious because most of the time the cell networks were completely maxed out. All I really wanted was a GPS device that would wake up and every 5 minutes post its position on a map. So I could just go to that map and I could see where everybody was and just keep track of them that way. And you know, it was a very, it didn't seem that complicated, right? So I said, okay, somebody must have thought of this. We went to Radio Shack, Best Buy, and all these places, and I just couldn't find it. And I said, well, that's remarkable. I mean, I know if I had this device in my hands, I could sell literally thousands, if not millions of them in just Manhattan alone. But the economics of consumer electronics are such that it's very hard to have an idea for a gadget and bring it to market quickly and at a price point that makes any sense for people to buy it. We'll talk more about that. But as time went along, I was playing with Legos with my son, and I said, you know, why can't you have a device, or at least a concept which is like this, where you can actually, you know, snap pieces and parts together like Legos. So like one block could be my GPS, the other block could be my wireless modem, plug it together, and voila, you have what you want. And the end result is there was no technical reason you couldn't do it. It was the economics. Where did my little thing go? So let's talk about the economics for a second. Anybody who's in the consumer electronics business will know these graphs very well. If you want to have a device, let's say I wanted to market this GPS device. Well, the way the world of mass market works is that I have to hit a certain price point. And to hit that certain price point, scale economies have to come to bear, which means I have to make lots of them, which means I have to sell lots of them. Okay? And then let's say I do that. Let's say I'm Motorola. Let's say I have the Razor. I come out with the Razor, bam, I'm selling bazillions of these devices. The problem with CE now is that you're a hit for only a couple of years, maybe 3. Maybe not even long enough to recoup the investment you made to have that hit. And so you have this big spike, if you're lucky, and then it trails off. All you have to do is ask Ed Zander that problem. Right? And this is a common problem with long tail businesses. It's a hit-based business, meaning you need to have a hit. If you don't have a hit, you're out of a job. If you get a hit, like Apple's done a phenomenal job, but Apple for a while, they didn't have any hits, right? And if you're going to have a hit-based model, you got to sell millions if you want to price it at the right point. And last but not least is this graph on the bottom, which is really what's happening in consumer electronics over the past 10 years. The average margins in consumer electronics are trending towards zero because China is eating everyone's lunch. Walmart, Best Buy are basically dictating prices, and it's very hard. So you have to do a couple things very well. One, you have to hit, you have to come up with a hit somehow, right? And if anyone has a guaranteed way of doing that, please let me know. There is a very hard, it's very difficult. And it's a two-year cycle usually. So you get a bunch of smart people in a room sitting around saying, okay, what are people gonna want? They come up with an idea, they engineer it, they bring it out to market, maybe 18 months later, 70% of the time they're wrong, all right? It's a very hard way to live, especially with these kinds of economics. Any questions about this? I can keep talking, but I'd love to get questions as we go. I mentioned Motorola. Another good example is Toshiba. Toshiba just lost the HD DVD wars. And it's funny, the day that they announced that they were getting out of it, their stock went up 13%, which is kind of weird. And the other thing that's funny is that by not pursuing it, they're going to save $550 million. I just find that funny. Because they bet the ranch on this thing. And that's again, it's a very hit-based model, and now they have to play catch-up. Sony has had its issues. PS3 was supposed to be the big next gaming console, and they've had their problems with that. Nokia, I put that up there not because they're doing fabulously well. They are sort of the ideal consumer electronics company in many ways. What's that? Yeah. Try using their software. Okay, this isn't an endorsement. I'm just saying out of the other ones. Yeah, I agree with that. But Nokia came out with their financials last year, and there was an astonishing figure in there which said that 30% of their 07 revenue came from products they introduced in Q4. Now, think about that for a minute. You have to be a company that can not only continue to crank out hundreds of new models and distribute them and support them and make them work in such a way that you can actually recognize the revenue on those on a quarter-by-quarter basis that makes such a huge impact to your bottom line. How many companies but Nokia can do something like that? It's very hard, very, very hard. So what's my point? My point is, here I am, a Joe average consumer who wants a device, wanted a wireless GPS, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And my choices were, and still are to many degrees, to sit around and wait for some big manufacturer to do it, to give it to me, to go and build it myself, and we'll talk about how hard that is. And absent that, I don't really have much choice. But what I have been trained for in the past 10, 20 years is that I want control. I like control, right? I have my TiVo. You know, my six-year-old now doesn't understand when we go on vacation and I can't pause, you know, Superman. He's like, what do you mean you can't pause it? Well, there's this thing called broadcast television. He's like, he doesn't get it. He doesn't want to get it. He's like, Dad, stop it. You know, rewind it. And I'm not, you know, it's hard to describe why you can't do that sort of thing. So we are all trained like that. And so now I'm faced with this, you know, I want to shoot video on my iPhone. Sorry. You're going to have to wait. And by the way, when you do get it, you're going to take the existing iPhone that you like and throw it in the garbage, get a whole new one. Right? So it's a model which seems sort of old. And it's definitely old when you consider how things work in the software space. So what if we could change that? What if we had a way that we could let consumers, and I don't even like the word consumers because it implies sort of a passive thing, but that's the word we all use, or users. What if we could enable them somehow so they could build what they wanted? Okay? And not just from the software standpoint, but from the actual hardware standpoint. So if you wanted the motion detector camera to do a real quick security thing in your house, you shouldn't have to go and buy this $400,000 proprietary home automation system that, you know, when you upgrade your next version of Windows, it crashes. You know, you shouldn't have to, you should be able to just get it. It's simple. It's a very common, simple type of device. Why can't you just go and build it? And that's I'm talking about me as an individual, but also communities can get together and do interesting things. And then how do you make it so that the world of atoms behaves a little bit more like the world of bits? Now, it'll never be exactly the same. But I think there are a lot of things that you can learn by studying how the software world and the digital world has progressed. specifically, I would argue that the open source way of doing things and open models of innovation are proving to be very powerful ways to motivate people. And then you also try to find ways to lower the barriers to innovation by keeping transaction costs low, by making it really easy for people to share. It's again part of the open source ethos. And you allow people to iterate quickly, come up with new ideas, test them out, see how they work, and so on. So those things, I feel, would be a great step forward for the world of atoms, specifically in the world of electronics. So let's just compare the two a second. Are there any software developers in the audience, people who've actually written software? Okay. So you'll recognize this, how this works. But in today, let's say I come out of college and I have this great idea. Say it's a great idea for a website of some kind, some social service, right? I can then go and find a bunch of code on the web, right? Open source allows me to go and source all kinds of interesting things. I can use free hosting and all this kind of web service stuff. And then I write my own code, I combine it together. And there's lots of easy ways to combine things now with XML and other interface standards, right? And there's this thing called a platform, which most people don't really recognize the power of because they just use it like a utility. But the operating system of your computer and the web are really platforms that abstract away an enormous amount of complexity. So you can just say, here's my idea for software. I can put it together pretty quickly in a source code form. And then I can utilize all this investment, this infrastructure, to do all kinds of things, from make it work to distributing it to fixing it to all sorts of things, right? The digital world looks like this. And I think it's the success of this model are well known. Let's say you have a great idea for a hardware device. None of you are going to find this surprising, but I'm going to go through it anyway. I come out of college, I have this great idea for a widget of some sort. Well, the first thing I need to do is I have to figure out, am I an electrical engineer? Am I a mechanical engineer? Am I an industrial designer? Or am I a logistics genius? Because I have to become a master of all these things pretty quickly. I have an idea, but now it has to be rendered in a schematic of some kind, which makes sense of the circuits and all the chips and so on. I have a bill of materials, which is all the different pieces and parts that go on that board. I have then something called a Gerber file, which is how the board is actually laid out. And then I've got a CAD file, which is how the plastic, which is going to go around. I mean, this is very complicated stuff. And not just the having to understand all that stuff, then you got to get the suppliers to even work with you. So we started Bug Labs a couple of years ago, and we were nothing. You know, we were a couple of people in a room with a couple dollars. And just trying to get suppliers to talk to us in terms of selling us their chips was a hassle, because we weren't going to buy 50,000 or 100,000 or whatever. And that was astonishing to me, because it really shouldn't be that. In software, I don't have that problem. I just go and buy stuff and I use it and I'm happy. In the world of electronics, it's a much different world. So let's say you do conquer that. Well, then now you got to deal with distribution, manufacturing, inventory. I mean, it's just a hard world. And this is where the difference between bits and atoms really sort of becomes an issue. And so it's hard to innovate in this kind of way, because I don't know anybody who's all these things, right? I'm certainly not. When we started the company, I had to go find all these different people, and it was an important part to make sure you got all this stuff, they all work well together. But there is an example out there that I think points a way. I'm not saying it's the way, I think it's just a way. And going back to my idea of Home Depot as a platform, it's an interesting realization when you say, okay, if I'm going to take a software idea and I'm going to try to actualize it, there's no friction anywhere, because I can just send things around free on the internet. But when you want to do things physically, then there are physical pieces that have to be managed, that have to be upgraded, and so on. And in most cases, I've found that if you want to have some sort of platform play in the hardware world, you need a company to be that. Okay? Lego has done a good job with Mindstorms. If anyone here has ever played with Mindstorms, it's a robotics platform that allows you to build robots very easily by using basically Legos. We've all used Legos. And the interface is the same. You look at it, you understand it, you snap it together, and it works. So in this respect, if I want to build a robot, then Lego has provided me a platform to do that. Now, they've made some decisions for you with respect to the colors of the bricks and what the sizes are, all that sort of thing. But by abstracting out a lot of the things that you would have had to worry about, which is like, what type of plastic is it? What are the dimensions? Finding the right vendors and all that sort of thing. They've now presented a platform that they're selling, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of kits a year, because people love it. And people love it because they can focus on what they really care about. You know, there was a big aha moment for me. It's going to sound silly in retrospect, but you know, we don't buy gadgets because we want gadgets. We buy gadgets because it gives us something we want in the form of information. I buy a camera because I want pictures, right? I buy a cell phone because I want to talk to my friends. I don't care so much about the physical form factor. That's not really important to me. What I want is the data, right? So in this case, I want to build a robot that sweeps the floor, right? That's what I want. So my choices, absent Lego, would be to go and find a bunch of people who know robotics, get out my, you know, welding torch and go crazy building a robot, or I can go buy a kit and I can focus on what I want and build it very quickly. And then the other thing that they've done is they have this notion of community, so I can actually share my experience and learn from others, all based on this standardized platform. So when you start talking like this, it starts to look very similar to how the software model works with the operating system, where it kind of creates a level playing field for people to talk about what they're doing. And Lego, the success of Lego, specifically the success of Mindstorms, I think is a good proof point. So I would argue that you can take that model and you could apply it to other spaces. Now again, I'm talking about electronics. So the idea here would be, I have an idea for a gadget. My idea is a wireless GPS, okay? So forget the gadget for a second. What does that mean? It means, okay, I want a device that keeps track of where it is, and then every adjustable amount of time will post its position on a website. That's what I want. That's the information I want. I don't care what form it takes. That's the information I want. So I come up with my functional spec. I could even write the software for that pretty easily. But now, what if you had a platform that you could just get the hardware in place as quickly and as easily as, say, with a Lego platform? That has been the basis of what Bug Labs has become. And the other thing we're trying to do, just like the prior slide, you know, Lego came out with something called Lego Factory, which is, if you want a brick or some sequence of bricks that you can't find, you can send them a file and they'll build it for you. Right, so they're trying to take one step farther, making it even further customized for your needs, which has been a big success for them. This argues the same point, which is, you know, you come up with your ideas, you can quickly build it using a platform which has the interfaces and other things defined, and then a company can offer the manufacturing inventory and sort of abstract away all that complex stuff. Very much like a threadless model where you can just go and design t-shirts and they take care of everything else. You don't care really if it's a Hanes t-shirt or a BVT or whatever. You just tell them what you want, white, this type of quality and so on, and they get it and send it out. So this platform, I think, is a powerful way of thinking about innovating in the physical space. So any questions? Am I being lively enough? I don't know. It's just not my nature. Okay, so, and I think the bottom line here is that if you can do this, and I want to talk about this for a second, if you can do this properly, and I'm not just saying my company, but in general, then it now starts to become possible to be the cheese. And I don't mean possible in the sense of an experiment, I mean possible in the sense of a business. And let me give you a couple examples. The device we have, which I'll give a demonstration of, is a modular device, and every sort of feature of the device comes in a form of a little module. And the modules have Braille on them. Now, we put Braille on it because we decided, you know, this is a visual indicator that we wanted people to see this and say, hey, you know what, this is really technology for everybody. It's not really just meant for the high priests of technology. It's meant for everybody. And it does, in fact, say, like, if you can read Braille, this will say motion, you know, it's a motion detector, or a GPS, what have you. And also just sort of looks cool if you don't know what it is. It's like these dots on there. I had a guy call me from the National Federation of the Blind. And I don't know if any of you work for that organization or know somebody who is completely blind. But one of the things that he said, he goes, finally, here's a company who's focusing on the needs of the blind. Now, I said, "That, yeah, okay." We are to an extent because we want people to be able to use this, and it does, in fact, work. But then, at a great conversation, he went on to talk about how there's 2 million completely blind people in the United States, way more than that worldwide. And for the most part, it is an ignored class of people when it comes to consumer electronics because it's just not big enough. It's just not big enough to get anybody excited to invest a lot of money to come up with solutions for them. There's a device out there, which is a great device. It's called GPS Trekker, which when you think about it, it's a totally obvious device. It's something that sits on your belt and talks as you walk. So you have your cane, you're walking along, it says, turn left in 5 feet, and you know, that's target. Your store is here. So it just guides a blind person as they walk audially, which makes total sense. Guess how much that device costs? $2,000. Right? That's the exact same response I had. I'm like, are you kidding? And it's not because they're trying to bilk blind people. It's just they can't, they can't make enough of them to bring the scale of economy down to the point where it makes sense. There are other devices like that, like color meters, things that will basically take the visual world and make it audio. All kinds of interesting devices out there, but they're all in the hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. And so he was excited because this idea, I could build a GPS tracker with basically the base unit and our GPS module by snapping them together, and that would be it. And that's a couple hundred dollars. So what we're saying is there are thousands and thousands of these little cheesy, that's not really what I meant, little niches that can be explored now economically because the platform basically takes and leverages the cost of individual platform pieces across multiple niches, right? So I'm an entrepreneur. Like, here's another thing which I didn't know. There's lots and lots of blind Java programmers, and they're all looking for things to do, and there's a device now. Hey, you know what? This could be for us. So let's say one of these guys says, hey, I'm going to be entrepreneurial, and I want to come up with an application which I know would be great for blind people. I'm going to use this platform. Now, they can worry about the application. They don't have to become an electrical engineer, mechanical engineer. They don't have to go to a VC and raise millions of dollars to take to Flextronics to build. They don't have to do any of that. All they have to say is, I know these are the five things that people are going to want. They want audio. They're going to want location. They may want some kind of tactile touch thing. And that's it. And because we can now provide, we or some other company can provide a modular-based approach, they can get the hardware literally in a couple of minutes, which is snapping things together, and then they focus on what they want. And so the GPS Trekker knockoff, if you will, would be a device which is mobile, battery-powered, put in your backpack or what have you, and they could offer that device very quickly, and we, or the company, could take care of the hard stuff, right? And so this conversation was a fascinating example. And another one, which is funny, I'll tell you. There's a company in New York which focuses on architectural, quote, experiences, where they'll come in and they'll put in big displays and so on, so that people can, when people are walking around the room, they interact with these displays. And it's been a big business for them. But what happens is that they prototype things with all the typical hardware prototyping tools like Arduinos and stamp, basic stamps and PIC and so on. And it's basically two guys back in a room with a soldering iron and the goggles on, and they're just coming up with this stuff. But every time an organization comes and they say, hey, we love that thing, give us 1,000, they're like, well, I can't, you know, you're gonna have these guys in the back room solder together, you know, no, it's not gonna happen. And so they've been constrained because they don't wanna get into the business of this hardware stuff. They don't wanna go and again have to approach a contract manufacturer and deal with all that stuff. And so what they like about a platform approach is that they can build the device that they want quickly, focus on the application, and then if someone turns around and says, give me 2,000, give me 10,000, they can just say, okay, buy that platform over there, and then, right? There's another example. These are niches that the audience members can be measured in the thousands, tens of thousands, right? And so from a business standpoint, being one little niche in that sort of the cheese of the pizza was a very hard place to live. But if you can find a way to aggregate all those little niches in a way that makes economic sense, then you got 1,000 entrepreneurs selling 1,000 gadgets, that's 1,000,000 units, that's not so bad, right? That's what the promise of Longtail is all about, and that's kind of where we as an organization are focusing. Does that make sense? But wait, there's more. I actually used this in a presentation with a gentleman who is from South Africa, and he looked at me like I had three heads. He's like, who is that guy? Do we all know who this is? Okay, no, it's Columbo. Again, I feel old. Oh, move on. Okay, there's an added benefit, I think, to openness. And we've seen this also with digital. And I think it could also become true with physical. And we've all heard of the Internet of Things, right? We've all heard of the Internet of Things. And the Internet of Things basically means that everything will have an IP address. My toaster will talk to my garage door opener, which will talk to my email server. I mean, you can set up anything you want. And the whole notion is this idea of network effects, where The more people join in a network, the more benefit is derived from every individual node. Well, I think you now are going to be able to see not social networks made up of people, but social networks made up of devices. And you're not going to get this unless you have some kind of openness between the devices. Right now, like my other company, when I had before this one, was a mobile enterprise software company trying to focus on building applications for devices that we're all running around with now. Blackberries, Palm Trails, Pocket PC devices, and so on. And it's a very hard place to live because there's no one platform. It's very hard to sort of figure out what you're going to run anywhere. But as open devices start coming out, you got Android making a big play here, Nokia with their Symbian piece. It's unclear how Apple's going to play in this space. But the notion here is that if we can find a platform, the platform is going to be the web in from a communication standpoint, but then how do you actually get applications running on devices? If we can get that working, then there is sort of this Facebook of gadgets kind of thing where my device can talk to your device in a way that I don't even necessarily have to be involved. So your GPS can tell my computer that you are heading in a certain direction. I can get an email saying you're going to be there in 5 minutes and so on. And this is a world which, you know, 10 years from now, I'm convinced, will look back and say, how on earth did we exist without that? Right? In the same way today with Google, you look back and say, 10 years, how did I exist without Google? These things are going to come along, and everyone's got an idea as to how this is going to work. But my feeling is that it's going to be based on an open platform. It's going to be based on a platform that's open, not just from the digital standpoint, but from the physical standpoint, where people, you know, not just the big heavy hitters like Samsung and Nokia and those guys are going to define this. It's going to be a bottoms-up type of approach in a similar way that's happened in software. And so one of the examples I like to use is that, you know, 10 years ago, I was getting most of my news from, like, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, like big media conglomerates. Today, I'm just as likely, if not more likely, to get my news from Robert Scoble, you know, Michael Arrington, and whomever, and these are individuals, right? I don't think it's so hard to believe that 10 years from now, we're going to be getting devices not necessarily just from the Samsungs and the Sonys of the world, but I could be getting them from you. Right? You may have a special device that you have a website for that solves a particular problem, and that's going to, I think, be commonplace. And one of the things that's going to drive the usage and the value of that are things like this. Okay, so that's sort of the end of my presentation. I was going to jump into a little demonstration of what we have at Bug Labs. But before I do that, I want to take any questions about, yeah. Yeah, so you ever hear the question? The question was, why can't the Bluetooth and network interfaces sort of take the place of or be the glue that puts all these things together? And the answer is it can't. I think it will. The real question, though, is how do the applications reside on the device? So at some point, the application has to talk to the hardware. And I think that's been the issue to date, is that even though Java has this run or write once, run anywhere paradigm, every JVM on every device is different. Right? And one of the things that Microsoft did, rightly or wrongly, is that they created basically a level playing field. So if I, as an independent software designer, said, hey, I'm going to spend $10 million on this application, I knew I could reach 90% of the population, right? It's not really true today. If I come up with a great design for a mobile device, I can't say it's going to run on 90%, it's just not. But we're going to get there. And that's kind of what I'm saying, is that we can get there in a way that says we're going to sit around and wait for the big guys to do it, or we can find a way to innovate it ourselves. And I think the internet and the web have proven the power of the bottoms-up kind of innovation model. You know, a good proof point to this is just a quick segue. I was discussing sort of this similar thing with somebody about Microsoft and how do you compete with Microsoft or Apple even. And if you look at what has been the only force that's been able to compete with Microsoft today? Open source. Well, Google, definitely. But if you look at just their core method, which is, you know, having tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of engineers cranking out the code, how do you compete with that, right? Well, what open source basically said is now, well, that's fine, but we've got millions of developers all connected by this community. And Microsoft can't really compete with that. And my argument is that if you were to try to start a company like Microsoft today using their same model, which is a closed architecture, totally proprietary, based on hard lock-in of your users, you couldn't become Microsoft today. Because open models of innovation, I think, are the way of the future. And I think anybody who has that model, they could be doing really well. Apple's doing great. RIM is doing fabulously. Bloomberg is doing fantastic. These are all proprietary. I'm not saying they're going to go away. But it'd be hard to start a company today that would look like that and be as successful as they've been. I think the model in the future is going to look very much like MySQL, right? Where it's an open source type of company. I don't know what their revenues were, but it was something like $53 million. And they were bought for $1 billion in cash by Sun. And I think that's because Sun recognizes, as do other companies, that the community is more valuable than just the revenue stream that they bring in. And so my feeling is that to achieve this, we're going to need to have that kind of dynamic. Does that make sense? Yes. This is whiskey. Yes, liquid courage. We have a notion which we call radical openness, and we're doing it not so much because we want to just be radical. It's because we want to be completely different than other companies out there with respect to how consumer electronics come to market. So everything is open source, meaning everything that I had on the slide before in terms of the schematics, the bill of materials, the Gerber files, the CAD files, are all open source on our website. They will be on the 17th, actually, when we launch. And the reason we do that is because we are firm believers in this notion of if you give people the appropriate tools, they will create extraordinary things. And so it's hard to have a message which says, you can have whatever you want, except for this. Because what happens is that no one will trust you. One of the investors in my company is a guy named Bob Young, who is the founder of Red Hat. And Red Hat did $500 million in revenue last year giving away their product. And he has a lot of funny stories about how you actually can achieve that, which seems very counterintuitive. But the way you do it is that, you know, most people worry about open source as being something where, hey, you know what, some potential competitor can come and grab all your stuff, branch it, and just completely knock you off. And there's absolutely that risk. But I would argue that that's not really going to happen until we're making a lot of money, I don't think, because this is so speculative. In Red Hat's example, what typically happens is that people come and they say, hey, look, I like the idea of free. So they'll come and they'll get the source code and they'll play with it. But they'll also notice that Red Hat is investing millions of dollars in pushing the envelope in terms of features and security and all sort of thing. And they want to stay aligned with that. They don't want to branch. They don't want to fork the code and go off in their own direction, because that would mean they have to hire lots of programmers and become experts in an area they don't want to be experts in. You know, Linux now, an enterprise level version of Linux has like 600 moving pieces. Right, so instead of them trying to manage it on their own, they pay Red Hat a fee. It's called a subscription fee, not a lot of money, a subscription fee to stay locked in with how they're sort of leading the market. Okay, that's very similar to how I think our model is going to work. If you want to take all of our source code, all of our schematics and everything, and build one of these, you can. You will owe us nothing. It's a GPL type of formula, though, so the innovations you make have to come back in. Right? So that's a little bit of a barrier, but there's nothing stopping somebody from just going and knocking us off entirely. And the feeling is that for us, I think this is true in open source in general, is that we are a firm believer in the power of community. We feel like we're going to get more out of the community than we're going to actually put in, as part of that whole network effect. And it's when we were at CES, we had a number of OEMs coming in asking us, hey, Cole, what's your engagement model? What's your licensing fee? And we said, there is none. And literally, they're looking around for the camera saying, this has got to be a joke. You know, this is a candid camera. And the answer is no, and it's just not how it works. And because what we really want is we want a lot of folks doing hardware modules and just adding to the collection and the value of the community. And we don't monetize that ourselves anyway. But we hope to generate revenues in the same way as Red Hat, which would be providing services around actualizing the devices and so on. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Stupid. I'm not like
I'm glad you asked that question. One of the nice things about having a microphone is you can be dramatic.
I'm glad you asked that question.
Okay. It's a very good question. I get it all the time, which is, do you really expect the millions of people out there to suddenly become gearheads and want to make their own devices? The answer is no. So let's be clear. And the target audience initially for us, and I think anybody who has a platform, just like Lego, are the early adopters, the people who are like to tinker and play with things. But let's also not make a mistake and think that's a small market. It's actually a very large market. Worldwide, it's, I think if you look at robotics as an example of sort of that mind, it's like a $2 or $3 billion market today. But that really isn't the end goal. The end goal, to really understand, I think what we're looking at, I think you have to go back in time a little bit to say 1976 when the first microcomputers first came out. The microcomputers came out, and the only people who were interested in the microcomputers were the early adopters, right? The nerds, the propeller heads of the world. And they said, hey, you know what? Finally, I have the ability to innovate in my desktop. I don't have to go to my school or my organization, timeshare and all that kind of crap. I can just do it on my own terms. And in many ways, if you look at Apple's marketing messages back then, it really was power to the people. Like literally, it was, you know, power to the people. And that's, you know, Bill Gates was a PC on every desktop, right? It was a very populist message. Not that everyone was going to go get a computer, but that was the idea. So 10 years later, it was sort of coming true. The microcomputer had basically wiped out the mini computer business and caused a lot of innovation. Now, you could argue what the value of that innovation was at that time, but a couple of key things came out of that. One was a product called VisiCalc, which was the first spreadsheet software, a couple of things, database software, and so on. And I don't think that would have happened unless the microcomputer had made its way. And maybe it could have, maybe not, I don't know. But the point being that the idea here, and the reason I brought this up, is we're trying to find a way, us and others, I should say, not just Bug, so that we can provide a hardware platform so that people say, look, you know what I really want is a wireless GPS. Say, okay, I go and I can build it. By snapping together two components, I can actually build the device in like 10 seconds. I then connect it to my machine, and there's a development environment which will recognize what I have plugged in. I can demo this. And I could say, this is a whole development environment, so if I know Java, I can program my application. And then over here, this is called BugNet, and this is a community of applications where it says, these are all the applications that the community has written that will work on the device that you have plugged in. Right? So if I have, I think it's a camera and a GPS plugged in. These are all the apps that use those modules, and they're rated so I can just drag and drop them and be done. So the first couple steps here are the innovator comes up with a cool device and makes it available, and then someone else can come and consume it. I'll give you an example. I was at CES, and I was demonstrating basically a totally programmable GPS device, and a guy comes up in a suit and he says, I need one of those. I said, wow. You don't look like a geek. And he said, what do you do? And I said, what do you do? He goes, I'm an account manager. And I spend most of my day in the car, and I have a very nice car, but that it has a very nice GPS. The problem is that the GPS doesn't do something which I really need, which is I want the GPS to know if it's Monday through Friday, not a holiday, and between the hours of 9 and 5. Because if it isn't in that area, I am working. And I want the GPS to keep track of where I go. Because at the end of the year, I want to print it out, and I want to submit it to the IRS, under my non-reimbursed business expense deduction, which is worth thousands of dollars to me, which he doesn't do right now because he has to now write it all longhand, which he never does. And so this is an example, it's kind of a stage two example of somebody who's not a geek but has a real need. And he doesn't care what it looks like, really, because it's going to sit in his car. And he was like trying to give me his credit card number at the event. I said, I can't sell to you yet, but we actually built the application. Because it's a simple application, we actually built it in the booth while he was standing there, and you know, voila, we had it. And for him, it was like, what do you want for this thing, right? And so there are a category of applications where, you know, this doesn't look like the iPhone. It's not going to be the iPhone. But there are some instances where it doesn't really make that much of a difference. The third piece, and I think really goes to what your question is all right. Still, modularity still takes a certain amount of technology, comfort to use this. Well, the next step would be, I come up with my, let's use this example, my GPS sales tracker logger. And I know that I can sell tens of thousands of these to my buddies and so on, other salespeople have this problem. Well, one of our services is to make it not modular. So we can actually strip it down and make it a single function device, just like you would buy from Garmin or Magellan or whomever, and then either sell it ourselves or sell it on your behalf, right? So we're not, see what I'm saying? So it's, you have the raw innovators like myself who really just want it to be modular because I want to come up with little things as like a toolkit. The second step would be folks who are a little less sensitive to the fact that it's not, you know, an iPhone. And the last piece would be using this as a rapid prototyping platform to come up with what you want, then maybe going raising money, right? So it's kind of this path. Now, the other thing to keep in mind, and this, again, is a little bit of a difference, but very much in keeping with our open idea, is that as applications get written, there is no hard lock-in between those applications and our hardware. So I write a device, let's say I write this GPS tracker. The GPS, all it requires is an LCD screen and a GPS. Well, a lot of us are carrying devices like that right now that have GPSs and LCD screens, right? So there's nothing stopping anybody from going and taking that application, putting a JVM with the appropriate JVM on this device and running it there, right? And that's nice because as an ISV then, I'm not stuck by having to say, well, my total audience is constricted by the number of people who actually buy bug hardware, right? It's constricted by the number of devices that can run the JVM, right? So it's a way for us to, again, offer a branch off from the traditional path, which is hard lock-in, meaning if we were to do this the old-fashioned way, we'd have our own compiler, we'd have our own interpreter, all this stuff, which you wrote an application for this, it's sticking there, buddy. You're not good. Like if I write an application for the iPhone today, I'm not gonna run it on a Nokia device, right? That to me is the old model. The newer model is based on leverage. It's based on the idea of running it once, spreading it across, and having lots of, because I think other, absent that, you're not gonna get that the network effect that I mentioned earlier. Yeah. Sure. I don't know if you all heard the question. The question was, he wants me to talk a little more about the sort of the stage three idea, which is you have an idea for a gadget, but the way it's designed now, it looks like this. And your end users aren't going to want this. They're going to want smaller, cheaper, all that sort of thing. One of the services that we provide, and we're hoping others provide as well, is taking that from a functional standpoint and making it aesthetically what you want, right? So, and the reason why I think we're well positioned to help you with that is because one, we understand the entire system from a software standpoint. Plus, we designed all the hardware so we know how that works. And so part of our design services would be, you know, so your classic, what do you need? How do you want, you know, what's the price point you're searching for? And we can come up with that. And then we actually build the device to those specs using the application framework that we already have in place. And the nice thing about doing that, in our opinion, is that all those devices are still participants in the greater community of applications. Right, so they don't become sort of orphans. They become just, but you know, other nodes in what we're hoping is becoming a community of interest that's based on this notion of open hardware. And so, if you've got this idea and you built it, then the next step, if you think you have a market that you can serve that's big, then you could probably raise money with this as a prototype. And then you raise the money and you talk about, okay, well, what is the market? How do you want to approach it? What's the design? And we'd have the services to make that happen. Don't do that. Yes. Yep. So the question was, how do we optimize a device like this? Because a lot of decisions, we've had to make a lot of decisions for you, right? And that's not an easy answer. And let me just back up a second and say, we're not suggesting that this is going to displace every known way of innovating in hardware. We're not saying that. There's plenty of good ways of doing it. And there are ways that have to be heavily optimized. I mean, if you want something the size of a nano, you know, you really got to focus on what that is going to require. But what we are suggesting is that if I ask the question, how many people here think we've designed and built every gadget we'll ever need? Right? No one's going to raise their hand. Maybe some people will. Get out. And I think it's just an intuitive response that, you know, there are lots of things that we haven't invented. And just sort of, I think if you're technical at all, you have this sort of faith that we're going to continue to come up with cool stuff. The question is, how do you actualize those cool ideas? And if you're talking about electronics, in the existing world of CE, it's very hard to go from an idea to something. It's just hard. And so we're trying to address that. Like, people are still going to come up with their brilliant ideas for one thing, which they know they're going to sell millions, and they're going to go raise $100 million and go do it, right? And God bless them. But I think for all the areas, for markets that have been unapproachable, this is a way to do it in a way that's cost effective. Now, and so the optimization that we make is in exchange for that. But part of the hope, and again, so the earlier graphs I showed with China basically taking the margin out of the business, it also means it's getting a lot cheaper to build electronics. So if I come up with an idea using a modular approach, and I don't need it to be modular for my core audience, then the economics now say, because the platform has been figured out, we can go and build devices pretty cheaply for that target market and keep it at a price point which makes sense. Okay, so there's a balance. Super hard optimization versus a flexible approach to innovation, which allows a little more freedom to get things done. I don't have the answer to that question because just like, I love anecdotes, so here's another one. I was CES, robotics pavilion, and on one table was this robot, it was like this tall, it was gorgeous, anodized aluminum, beautiful thing, doing Tai Chi, like literally just, you know, walking down, and it was rolling, standing on its head. I was like, holy smokes, that's awesome. And that was, I mean, how much is that thing? That's $5,000. Okay, next. I go to the Lego Mindstorms place, and they have like a robot opening a jar of peanut butter or something, you know. And it didn't look at all like this one over here, but I realized that it's a completely separate market, right? I wouldn't buy that robot because I wanted to open my jar of peanut butter, right? I'd buy this thing over here because I don't really care if it looks great opening a jar of peanut butter, and tomorrow I want it to be my vacuum cleaner, so I'm just gonna, right? It's a separate market, and today we really only have one market segment in consumer electronics, which is the optimized, single function, obsolete in 6 months model. What we're suggesting is there might be another market, right? And they will intersect. It's not clear exactly how that's going to work, though. Sure. Yeah, but that's a good point. And what he was also saying is that you can spend a lot of time on trying to, say, optimize power management and so on. But the good news about our approach is that because it's open source, you don't have to wait on us to do it. Somebody else could figure that out in Norway and have like the greatest example of power management and make it available to the community. You know, I have a great camera. It's a Canon camera. But if some guy comes up with a better white balancing algorithm, I'm stuck. I can't do anything. Canon is what Canon is. But if you have an open source sort of community-based idea, if somebody comes up with a better power management, boom, I can go grab it, right? So, you know, I have a few engineers, but I'm hoping to harness the hundreds of thousands of potential engineers that might be interested in this. Yeah. Can we get volume on the this? That's a great question, and absolutely. In fact, one of my presentations that I pitched to investors is that consumer electronics is an example of a lose-lose-lose situation, right? It's a losing situation for producers because it's so hard to innovate and have a hit. It's a lose situation for us because every 6 months we have to go get a new iPod, and we then get a new AC adapter, which sits in a drawer, which I now have 100 of them. I don't know what to do with them. But the last lose situation is the environment, the Earth. We're cranking out hundreds of millions of cell phones every single year, all with lithium-ion batteries, all ending up in landfills. It's a disaster. It is a full-on disaster. And so, while I'm not going to stand up here and say, this is a green device, what I will say is, this and modular devices like this can become a lot of different devices that you currently have as separate things. So for me, it's a GPS, it's a PDA, it's a digital camera, and it's all one battery, right? It's one piece of plastic. All the plastic we're using is recyclable. The thing is designed so you can take it apart so that remanufacturers can take it apart and do whatever they want with it. We don't use any toxic paint and so on. So yes, and I think another benefit of modularity is that. Is there a cost? Yes. It's not going to look like an iPhone, probably. And to some people, that's important. But others who really don't necessarily care or don't necessarily want to have 50 lithium-ion batteries in their life, it makes some sense to have one base that powers lots of things. So you're not going to see that in some headlines in our marketing stuff, but it's absolutely part of our story. Glad you asked. Hey, wait a second. I'm not sure. Do I have a demo? Oh, I have a demo. All right. 1 second. How much time do I have? Kind of hard to do with two hands. Okay, so what I have here, and anybody wants to see it later, I can show you. It is something we call a bug, and I'm just going to demonstrate something.
You'll see that there's an LCD screen on here, and you can't see it. It's running Qtopia, which is a PDA. One of the nice things about the bug is that I can take the modules and put them anywhere. So I can take off this LCD screen and then put it there. Right? And now it's going to boot up X Windows. And so I've got X Windows on the bottom. I can actually have two LCD screens, right? One running Qtopia, one. And some people might ask, why would you want two LCD screens? And my son, 6 years old now, had one. He said, Dad, Nintendo DS. And on the other side is a camera. All right? And so I can plug in a camera. And this is a motion detector and accelerometer. So let's say I wanted to, let me plug it in. So now this device is the base is really just a Linux computer. It's a general purpose Linux computer. It's running a 532 megahertz ARM 11 and running 2.6.19, and it's just a standard general purpose consumer electronics, general purpose computer. So you see what happened now is that I open this up. Okay, so now it gives me a view of what I have connected. And so now it's a camera device. Let's say I now wanted to plug in my motion detector. You see motion comes up. The screen's a little too big. Okay. Yeah, so I plugged it in here as it came in down the bottom there. I move my LCD screen, right, from here to here. Okay. Woo! So, woo! What could be more exciting than that?
Just stop right there.
So, the idea now is I can say, all right, well, that's kind of cool, but now I'm going to go to BugNet. Now, these are all the applications that have been sorted for me to say, okay, these are the things that could run here. And I can go look at them. These are provided by our community. We have some 800 people in our community already. This is up without even using any hardware. But these are just ideas that they've come up with. So let's say I have my GPS alarm clock idea. The GPS alarm clock is actually very ingenious. It is an alarm clock that goes off as you get close to something. And it was designed by a guy who kept falling asleep on the train and missing his stop.